The last time Brother Leslie spoke in Chicago, I was paid a compliment. A brother came up to me and he thanked me for Brother Jerry Leslie's talk. And I said, well, don't thank me, thank the brother. He said, no, he says, you're the committee that helped select him. So we received many blessings from Brother Jerry Leslie before, and I'm sure we're going to receive many more. He has chosen as his title, From Jordan to Jordan, Jericho. Excuse me. From Jordan to Jericho, Brother Jerry Leslie.
It is a delight to be in Chicago again and to renew our fellowship with so many of you, and look forward to the remaining sessions and particularly to the times of fellowship together and the days to follow. We would like to bring you love and greetings from the Portland Ecclesia, and we have selected a text of greetings for the month of May, which is Psalms 68, verses 19 and 20, particularly from the New American Standard Version, which reads, Blessed be the Lord who daily bears our burden, the Lord who is our salvation. God is to us a God of deliverances, and to God, the Lord, belong escapes from death. Brother Ray Luke and I must have been reading some of the same articles and material because some of the things that we will mention are some of the things that he mentioned. So if that occurs, just consider them a double emphasis, and perhaps they will have that extra impression upon our minds. Perhaps we will begin a little bit further down the line from Joshua and then come back to that point. Incidentally, all of our quotes will be from the Revised Standard Version. Let's begin with looking at Rahab. The story of Rahab holds an intrigue for the reader of history and the triumphs of Israel. First, because the events surrounding her were a turning point in the chronicle of Israel. Second, her conduct was an act of personal courage and faith. Israel had nearly turned into a nomadic people after 40 years. Their passage through Jordan had been resisted by the enemies of Israel. If they were to be preserved as a people, they must rise up with faith and claim their heritage in Moses. Now, under the military leadership of Joshua, they had the opportunity to conquer the promised land. The account is in Joshua chapters 2 through 6. The whole record began with some acts of faith. Joshua was one of only two spies that returned with a message of confidence 40 years before. Now he sends two other spies to report the prospects for a siege on Jericho. He knew from experience what dangers they might expect because he had been a spy before. The two spies crossed the short distance from Jordan, about 2 hours from Jordan to Jericho, and come to the gates of the city before the closing hour. Certainly, they dressed inconspicuously and mixed with the street traffic in Jericho. They came to the house of Rahab the harlot. Whether they followed her from a street corner or whether her house was marked, we are not told. Perhaps they thought this location would not be observed as peculiar for unknown visitors to enter. Nevertheless, their presence was reported to the king, even including their mission. We read in Joshua 2, verse 2, Certain men of Israel came here tonight to search out the land. Servants were sent to the house demanding they be delivered to their custody. Either shortly before or seeing the guards approach, she hid them on the roof among the stalks of flax. This indicated another trade for Rahab. Flax was used to make yarn, linen, and the base material that received dye and made into fabrics. Later, the use of a scarlet rope indicated the use or preparation of dyes as somewhat related to her trade. Nevertheless, when the guards arrived, she devised a response. It was a lie, but had enough plausibility to send them on their way. She said two had indeed come to her, but she did not know where they came from. Perhaps this indicates the men found her house rather than she soliciting their business. She said, two came to me. But then she adds that before dark, when the gates were about to be closed, they went out of the city. She also urges them to pursue quickly to overtake them. This was, of course, not true, but they followed her suggestion. So we read in chapter 2, verse 7, "So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut." At this point, Rahab makes a profound confession of faith. Verses 9 and 10. I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. Here she confesses the deity of Israel as being the Almighty. She acknowledges his providences in their deliverance and victory. She was well informed of the events of the Exodus. We don't know just how this information came to her, or if it was common knowledge to all. However, she seems to put her past reputation now behind her, identifying with this a special opportunity to assist the people of God. Her lie was actuated by a desire to save herself and family from destruction and to prevent further search for the spies in her house, as well as to protect their mission. While a lie is always a sin, in this case it was also mixed with faith in the living God. And so testifies Paul in Hebrews 11:31 concerning the faith of Rahab. It was not her lie, however, that justified her, but her act of faith to shelter the people of God. She goes on now to reveal a vital piece of information for the spies. This was very important information to them. Verse 11, "As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no courage left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God is he who is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." The key was that panic was spreading among the people of Jericho. Joshua would capitalize on this in the final siege. In chapter 2, verses 12 and 13, she goes on to plead for a vow in the name of God that as she had dealt kindly with them, that they should do so unto herself and household when the city should fall. In verse 14, they say, as their life is in her hands at this moment, so they will deal kindly with her if she does not reveal their business. So she let them down by a rope, as her house was against the city wall, and leaves them this advice in verse 16. Go to the hills, lest the pursuers meet you, and hide yourselves there 3 days, until the pursuers have returned. Then afterward you may go your way. In verses 18 to 21, the spies give her a sign and conditions for their deliverance. When we come unto the land, you shall bind this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. That's the Revised Standard Version. We think that this rendering means that it was the same cord by which they escaped, probably made of hemp or flax red with dye, that was to stay in the window and mark her home. Verse 19. If anyone goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be upon his head. Both the scarlet sign from the door or window and the penalty for leaving the house correspond to the same injunctions for the Passover in Leviticus 20. These were the marks of faith for a Jew, not a Gentile. And Rahab now subscribed to them. The scarlet from the window or the door, and the penalty for leaving the house. In verse 21, they say they are not bound by their vows if she should betray them. West of Jericho is an almost vertical cliff rising to a mountain plateau which bears the name Carantal or Carantania, depending on the dialect. It rises to a height of 1,200 to 1,500 feet and is honeycombed with caves. This is the traditional Mount of Temptation, not because Jesus later necessarily climbed it, but because of its imposing view. From quite a distance, one could have seen far and wide. Here was Satan's point of focus for the third and last temptation on Jesus in the wilderness. From this lofty mental view, he was offered the kingdoms of the world. It was here that the spies hid for 3 days. Our mind is somewhat carried to the last days of this old order. But as with Jesus, we may be kept from the hour of temptation which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth, Revelation 3:10. Not because we are not to live in it, but because the meek of the earth shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. After the pursuers return empty-handed, the spies passed over Jordan to give their report to Joshua. If it had not been for Rahab, they would not have had this inside information and may not have returned at all. Verse 24. Truly, the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and moreover, all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of us. This was Rahab's report. Vital information. This was essentially the same report that Joshua gave 40 years before, but which Israel then had not sufficient faith to accept. Now, brethren, notice some remarkable features of this chapter. First, it was a reformed woman that provides the safety for the Lord's watchers. Second, the events occur in the evening near the time of the closing of the city gates to a pagan city. Thirdly, there is a faithful remnant left in the city, namely Rahab and her family. Fourth, they assert their faith in the God of Israel in this hour of trial. Five, the Passover signs and conditions are given, if not exactly, but very similarly. Sixth, the escape cord is also given as a sign of deliverance. Seventh, God's servants flee to the mountains for 3 days. And eighth, a faithful message for victory is delivered to Joshua. Here seems to be the ingredients for a parallel to the final days of this old order and our deliverance in this record. Prior to victory, Israel had endured 3 40-year periods marked in Moses' life. First, from those ark of reeds in the water to the throne of Egypt. Second, from the throne to the exile in Midian. And third, from the Exodus to Canaan. There were tests of faith at each juncture. What for us? Let it not be another 40 years to prove our faith. Let us rise up and enter into our promised land. Chapter 3 continues the narrative. Here, Joshua rose early in the morning and came to Jordan. There he lodged for 3 days, apparently for divine direction and spirit. Verse 5 says the people were to sanctify themselves, which probably included feet and general washing. We are inclined to think this was the same 3 days before which the spies were returning from the mission that Joshua waited with expectation while they were in hiding. Joshua is a picture of Christ. Joshua is the Old Testament version of the name Jesus. He too rises up early in the millennium. After the first 3.5 years of his presence, Christendom is judged and rejected. The Lord's people are called out. Some flee to the mountains. Others will be rescued later. Some, like these spies, flee to the mountains directly from the housetops, neither coming down to take anything out of the house. Matthew 24. All this began in 1878, the same year that Israel's double was complete and beginning a return of favor to them. Though we are not inclined to make a timetable from Jericho, we are impressed with the 3 days before marching orders were given. Now some very detailed directions for crossing Jordan are given. We read in chapter 3, Joshua 3, verse 3 and 4, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it, that you may know the way you shall go. For you have not passed this way before, yet there shall be a space between you and it, a distance of about 2,000 cubits. Do not come near it." And Brother Luke reminded us of this setting this morning. This was not a new way for Israel, or this was rather a new way for Israel, and a sort of intimation and of what lies before in this crossing of Jordan. It was a struggle of faith. It was an initiation into their new homeland by way of Jordan. The priests were to precede them while the people maintained a distance of 2,000 cubits between themselves and the priests. This distance became the premise for a rabbinic tradition of a Sabbath day's journey being 2,000 cubits, referred to in Acts 1, verse 12. It was the distance in which sanctity and reverence could be maintained. But now notice some peculiar events surrounding the priest's role. In chapter 3, Joshua 3, 8 through 17. When the priests bore the ark and came to Jordan, they were to stand on the edge with their feet in the water. At this moment, all the waters flowing from upriver were cut off because of a dry riverbed. This was to be a sign of God with them, and that he would drive out the enemies of the land. Inasmuch as the priest stood in the midst of the riverbed, while the nation passed over, and yet maintained a distance of 2,000 cubits, perhaps indicated that they stood somewhat upriver from the main crossing of the body of people. Else, if they were directly ahead and waited, then the people would pass directly by them and would violate the 2,000 cubit limit. It was as if these priests were there holding back the waters, providing a way for the people. Moses had parted the waters with his rod, the Red Sea, 40 years before. Joshua now did the same to the Jordan, with the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. It is God's covenant that has center stage upon the entrance upon the promised land. And the feet of the priests submerge in the Jordan when the miracle occurs. We are compelled to consider Revelation 16, verse 12 in this connection. The sixth plague. The sixth angel poured his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings of the east. There is a detail in these events that should not be overlooked. Returning to Joshua 3, verses 15 and 16. The Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest. The waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap far off at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those flowing down toward the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were wholly cut off. It was the season when the melting snows of Mount Hermon swells the Jordan. Jordan flows through a narrow canyon near the city of Adam. Apparently, God's providence used a landslide to block the waters for a time at this point. This has happened three times in recorded history, three other times. In the year 1267, a landslide blocked the river for 16 hours. Again in 1906, and again in 1927. But notice the city name. We think the recording of the point of severance being Adam is more than a coincidence. As we were reminded earlier today, the name Jordan means judged, and often finds a picture in death that began with Adam. Elijah smites and crosses it. Elijah does. Elisha does so again. The leprous Naaman, captain of the Syrian army, was cleansed by washing in Jordan seven times. And Jesus is baptized in Jordan. And now Israel crosses to the promised land when the judgment is cut off, beginning at Adam. This was the time of harvest. Is it too much to see a correspondence at the time of the Gospel Age harvest? At the end of one age and the opening of another, Is this not part of God's foresight, marked in Scripture, of the entrance of mankind, beginning with Israel, into the kingdom opportunities, once the curse is cut off from Adam and thence to all mankind downstream? Joshua 4 records a wonderful account of two groups of 12 memorial stones. A representative from each of the 12 tribes took up a stone amidst Jordan and placed the collection of 12 in Gilgal as a memorial for their deliverance. Chapter 4, verse 6 and 7. This may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, "What do these stones mean?" Then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. Without a great deal of imagination, we see in these 12 stones carried into the promised land a picture of natural Israel. When Israel is fully reconciled, that will be the signal for life from the dead. Romans 11, verse 15. But another 12 were gathered together and placed where the priests stood in the very midst of Jordan while the people passed over. This is recorded in verses 9 and 10. These stones remained in the midst of the river after the waters returned as a memorial of the priests' sacred role in the deliverance. What were these other 12 stones left in the midst of the river? Are not these the faithful priesthood, spiritual Israel? Ours is not an inheritance in earthly Canaan. Our earthly lives will remain a memorial committed to death with our head for the sake of the world's deliverance. About 40,000 warriors were prepared for battle. The people came through Jordan on Nisan 10. This was the day for Israel to accept the Passover lamb into the home and family. When Israel accepts Christ as the Messiah, it will be a new day for them and for mankind. Chapter 5 records that the males were circumcised, reaffirming their consecration and heritage in the Abrahamic covenant. This was a return to the covenant and removing of the reproach of Egyptian slavery. They kept the Passover on the 14th at evening in Gilgal. The following day, the manna ceased because now they could eat the bread of the new land. And thereupon followed the seven-day feast of unleavened bread. Finally, an angel appears before Joshua with these awesome words. Chapter 5, verse 13. A man stood before him with his drawn sword in his hand, and Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord bid his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place where you stand is holy." The battle to ensue is the Lord's, not man's, and it is not ours. The battle is the Lord's. Though previously we saw in Joshua a picture of Jesus and particularly of Christ in Israel's deliverance, we cannot avoid the compelling title here given, Commander or Captain of the Army of the Lord, as being the same as the General of Jehovah in removing the remains of the old order while the new sweeps its way to victory in this our day. Now, in the sixth chapter, we return to the citadel of Canaan and the home of Rahab. From childhood, we heard how Joshua heightened the state of panic with those seven marches around the city in 7 days. Seven priests march ahead of the ark with seven ram horn trumpets. These were the same trumpets to be blown on the Jubilee. These were not the silver trumpets of the temple service, but the large ram's horn which gave a loud and far-reaching alarm. This was no surprise attack. Jericho well knew they were under attack and were gripped with fear. They knew their old empire and institution was under the most dire siege. And the forces of God used each day emphasized this message. For 6 days they circled the city, once with trumpets blowing. On the seventh, they circled seven times. On completing the last circuit, the trumpets blew and the people shouted victory, and the walls fell. The walls were built against the slope of the hill, as both served as a retaining wall and to extend the height of the defensive positions. If the event was accompanied by an earthquake, which it well might have been, perhaps earlier tremors precipitated even the landslide upon Jordan that began at Adam, the walls would have fallen outward, away from the trembling mound within. The inhabitants probably now fled their defenseless position. Israel plundered the gold, silver, and bronze for the treasury. Before burning the city, Joshua gave instructions for the two spies to rescue the household of Rahab. They brought her father, mother, kindred, and all that belonged to her into the camp of Israel, and then burned the rest of the city. We will return to Rahab in a moment. But Joshua now issues a solemn oath against the city, found in Joshua 6, verse 26. Cursed before the Lord be the man that rises up and rebuilds this city, Jericho, at the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation, and at the cost of his youngest son shall he set up its gates. Notice, the curse is upon the firstborn. This event was within a week of the Passover, where the jeopardy of Israel's firstborn were memorialized. In Egypt, Israel's firstborn were spared, while Egypt's firstborn died. And Joshua now issues the same curse against Jericho. This is indeed a warning upon all who dare to rebuild the citadel against God's chosen people. There appears to be a special connection in these events with the final demise of Christendom, when God's people prevail in the end of this age. Notice Revelation 16 is also based on the plagues of Egypt and are called the seven last plagues. An angel pours out seven plagues just as the forces of Joshua circle the city on 7 days. The seven circling on the last day are almost a concentrated echo of the preceding omens. Many take the plagues to indicate a mostly historical process of breakdown of this old order. Others see a future final concentrated scourge on present institutions. But perhaps in this precedent of Jericho, there may be room for both applications, the 7 days and then the seven circlings to finish the process. There was both a progressive series that paralyzed the inhabitants and a final seven that affect their demise. Notice in Revelation 16, verses 18 to 21, we have many of the same ingredients in the fall of Jericho. Revelation 16, verse 18. The seventh angel poured his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne, saying, "It is done." And there were flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, and a great earthquake such as had never been since men were upon the earth. So great was that earthquake. The great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and God remembered great Babylon to make her drain the cup of the fury of his wrath. And every island fled away, and no mountains were to be found. And great hailstones, heavy as 100 weight, dropped on men from heaven, till men cursed God for the plague of the hail, so for fearful was that plague. Notice the same symbols in Joshua and in Revelation. Under Joshua, there was the sound of trumpets that terrorized the population. In Revelation, the plague is upon the air. One is the sound up in the air, the other is the plague upon the air. Under Joshua, there was the shout of the people. The walls collapse on a quaking foundation. In Revelation, we hear of voices, thunderings, and earthquake. Under Joshua, Jericho lies broken, defenseless, before the invaders. In Revelation, the city is broken into three parts. Under Joshua, Joshua's decree prohibits ever rebuilding the fortress. In Revelation, all the mountains and islands vanish to rise no more. In Revelation, it is from the completed body of Christ, from the temple, from the throne, the new heavenly administration that issues the final decree. Yet it is earthly Israel that is given the victory over all institutions who have defied the God of the institutions that have defied the God of Israel in this final collapse of the old order. And Israel will remain the central sanctified agency of the kingdom. These scenes are more detailed in Ezekiel 38 and 39 and even Ezekiel 37, the dry bones, and also in Zechariah chapters 12 to 14. So here in Jericho, it is natural Israel who prevail. Whatever else followed in their occupation of the land, God was sanctified in the eyes of all nations this day in Jericho. Joshua 6 verse 27 says, "His fame was in all the land." So it is with God's vindication of Israel. however antagonistic or conciliatory Christendom has acted towards Israel and Judaism, they have ever contended that the Jew must convert or seek Christ in Christendom's own definitions before they can be saved. It has been an age-long religious battle to define God, either as the God of the various sects of Babylon or the God of Israel. In this final conflict, God will reveal Himself, and it will surprise the masses of traditional Christianity. They will find their blessing in taking hold of the skirt of a Jew, not of priest and pulpit. Now, what parallel can we see in this Rahab? She married into the family of Israel. Whether her husband, Salmon, was one of the spies, we do not know. But she is listed in Matthew in the genealogy of Joseph. She bore Boaz, who married Ruth. Rahab was the great-grandmother, the great-great-grandmother of David. She is listed in Hebrews and James as an example of faith. We do not see in her a picture of the church, for they can be found in the priests who stood in the midst of the Jordan. Though she is listed personally as an ancient worthy in Hebrews 11, I think she does not represent them in these particular scenes. She was found in the midst of the pagan city with an unseemly background. She is rescued by Israel when the city collapses, and then shares a part with Israel's inheritance. I don't know if we have a named class to really label her role, and anything that we would say would be some speculation. However, there are those meek, yet exploited of the earth, those who never before took a stand against the systems that entrapped them, yet who in these latter days recognize God's providence with Israel. They may yet rise to the occasion to testify of the fearful condition around them and ask for shelter against the inevitable storm with the people of God, Israel. Will the awesome events of the near future awaken the conscience of some to take the sign of Israel's deliverance as the blood sign of their deliverance? Could Rahab represent the meek of the earth, who seek righteousness, seek meekness that they may be hid in the day of the Lord's wrath? Such modern worthies may well correspond with this ancient worthy woman of Jericho. Or, does she correspond to the great company who identify with spiritual Israel, but only after the faithful earlier left the city and after spiritual Israel cross over their Jordan? Yet they remain in defensed cities. These too will later find their family among the heavenly family. Like Elisha, they will receive the double portion only if they watch. These are only a couple of suggestions for you to think about as to where Rahab may find some picture in our day. We may not know for sure now. However, it is now our privilege to march with the Ark of the Gospel Age Covenant on our shoulders into Jordan and there stand and behold the salvation of our God. Let us not be weary in well-doing. We shall reap if we faint not.
May God add his blessing.
We'd like to thank Brother Leslie for his fine spiritual lessons. Led in closing prayer by Brother Jerry Leslie.
Lord, your Father in heaven, hallowed be thy most holy name. We wish to thank thee for the pictures, for the lessons of those faithful in Israel, the courage of their faith, the perseverance, and the trust in thee. Help us to apply these lessons to our hearts in this hour of temptation, that we may be faithful, that we may be part of the blessing and deliverance of this weary earth. Dear Father, we leave our lives in thy care and ask forgiveness for our shortcomings. Please help us to remain humble, teachable. Help us to be encouragers of each other and strengthen those things that remain. Dear Father, we now leave the continued fellowship of this convention and the lessons in thy loving care, in the blessed name, the merit of Jesus. Amen.